supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a jam-packed show for you today, cats and kittens. We are going to interview our favorite plant pathologist, Meg, no relation, McGrath from Rutgers University, about the dreaded basil blight that has made it so difficult to grow that delicious herb the last bunch of years. We're also going to tell you exactly what to do and not do with compost and shredded leaves to get your raised beds ready for the winter time. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls then at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thank you for making it, John. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Marmora, New Jersey.
Marmora. Yes, no, that's down in Cape May County, right?
That's right.
For many years, we haven't been there for a couple of years, but the annual pilgrimage from when I was a child to when my kids were small would be to take the Garden State Parkway down to Wildwood. And I always remember seeing Marmora up on the signs there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, always thought it was an interesting name. All right, what can we do for John who's down the shore?
Yeah, I don't have a question today. I called to beg to differ with you about black walnuts. You talked to a gentleman that gathered some and wanted some information on how to process them. And
I knew I was going to get in trouble for that phone call. Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, I made a similar statement about black walnuts, and it took over the letters page for the next 4 months. Okay, so you like tell us your story. Tell us how much you love black walnuts and everything I got wrong.
Well, we used to gather them when we were kids. I lived in Northeast Philly and down in the Pennypack Park there. It was a city park. We used to go and gather them. What we did was, to make it simple, we just wore old shoes and just, like, ground the holes off right on the ground. We didn't even pick them up. Once they had, like, a green hole around them, and it starts turning yellow and brownish, and it comes off pretty easy if you just sort of roll it around under the sole of your foot. I mean, my daughter went out and gathered a bunch, because I haven't done it for a while. I said, you know what, let's go get some walnuts. And I did the same thing, and it was just as easy as it was then. Just smashed the hole off, and then if you just wear some rubber gloves, you could pick up the walnut and throw it in a paper bag or whatever. We gathered a bag full last week, and I normally we would just lay them out on, like, hardware cloth. We made, like, a shelf with hardware cloth, and we just lay them out on there to dry. But last week I took an extra step and put them in a big bucket of water, and I had a wire brush on a long pole, sort of stirred them around with that and ground off the rest of the hole with that, and then drained off the water, and it came out pretty clean. So if you just dry them, you can't eat them right away. If you eat them right away, they do taste horrible. We always let them sit a couple months. By Christmas time, they're usually ready to crack and then use in Christmas cookies and stuff, and they have a lot of flavor. In fact, if you buy them at their store, they're in the baking aisle. They're usually they're about $2 an ounce, I think. They're pretty expensive.
Now, wait a minute. Are you talking, I know you can go into a store and buy walnuts.
Like the Acme here where we live, in the baking aisle, they have, there's tiny little bags, you probably wouldn't even notice them, like 2 or 3 ounces, and they're usually crushed up.
And it says black walnut.
Yeah, black walnuts, yeah, and they have a lot of flavor. If you just add maybe a half a cup to a batch of cookies or some walnut bread, it just adds so much more flavor. So that's primarily what they're used for, I think, in baking. But you can't eat them. They do have a strong flavor. Like you said, it might be an acquired taste to some. I like them. But
how did you crack them? Because the story I told about breaking a vise at a Sears store was absolutely true.
Wow. No, I have a big, heavy-duty vise bolted to my workbench, and I use that. Sometimes what I do is, you might want to wear safety glasses, I'll wrap a piece of cloth around it, because when they break, sometimes pieces of shell fly off, so I sort of wrap a little strip of cloth around the nut in the vise, so when it does crack, you know, pieces don't go flying everywhere. Like a 3-pound sledge, and just if you have a hard surface to put it on. And again, I would put a cloth around it just so pieces don't go flying everywhere. I do have a heavy shell. And then you kind of pick the meat out. It's work, but I think it's worth it.
So this is, again, the attraction to men. There's a great risk of injury involved in the preparation here.
Yeah.
You know, anytime a man can swing a sledgehammer, he'll find an excuse to do it.
Yeah. Well, I like foraging, too. It's just neat getting out there and foraging for stuff, and my daughter got a kick out of it. Well, I don't know if I mentioned, I make black walnut cookies at Christmas time, and they're my the favorites. The kids love them. I mean, I can't make enough of them. So
you say that first aging the nut removes some of the sour flavor.
Yeah, they really taste awful at first if they're still green. And they'll actually make sores in your mouth, I mean, if you try to eat them that way. So, yeah, you need to let them dry out and age. We always let them go about 2 months.
Okay, which, again, obviously takes you right up to Christmas baking time.
Right.
All right. All right, John, I knew we were going to get black walnut reaction. I'm afraid it might turn into a black walnut show, but we'll find out.
That'd be interesting, yeah.
All right, thanks, man.
All right, take care. Thank you.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Peggy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am just ducky today, Peggy. Thank you for asking. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Peggy Fine?
Lambertville.
Lambertville, New Jersey, just across the free bridge from New Hope.
Yeah.
Beautiful area out there. What can we do for Peggy in Lambertville?
Well, you had a gentleman call up about black walnuts, and you were very adamant in your discouraging of his trying them. And I just wanted to present the other side of the story. And the other side of the story is I really like black walnuts, and they have a very distinct flavor, and you probably have to get used to it, like eggplant and okra and a few other things. But they're worth a try.
So I have a feeling I am going to be beat to near death over my black...
No, but I have to say that I have friends that live in Lafayette, Louisiana. And in Lafayette, there is supposedly the last remaining Borden's ice cream parlor. And every time I go to visit, I have to go at least once to Borden's because that's the only place that you can buy black walnut ice cream. And I have to do it every time I go because it's just really good.
Now, in this ice cream, is it just a flavor or are there real black walnuts in it?
No, it's just a flavor, but it's kind of hard. You don't usually get too many things with the black walnut flavor in.
Yeah, who would want sour ice cream?
No, it's not. But also, I wanted to say that at this time of year, if that caller ever listens to your show again, before he goes through all the trouble of trying to crack the black walnut, in the supermarket, I just saw them this morning in my supermarket in New Hope, there is already shelled and chopped up fine black walnut. So you can get them this time of year in the supermarket.
Now, which supermarket?
Giant.
Okay. So these things.
Last year, the Pennington Quality Market had them. And the year before, the IGA in Frenchtown had them.
Is this a national brand that packages them, or is some vagrant going around?
No, I think it's probably a smaller company. And some of the packages say that they come from Canada.
Really?
Because I've gotten them, they say Canada on them.
Okay. Well, the black walnut range does extend up there, that's for sure.
And then the thing is, you talked about using a vise, and that was how we got them open. But you had to use a really strong, like, industrial type of vise. Like, a little one doesn't really work. You have to have a really heavy-duty one.
Yeah, I broke the little one at Sears and then, you know, slunk away.
And I think, too, that I don't use the computer, but I bet if you look, there might be some kind of advice on how to crack them. I'm going to make a good guess.
Well, see, when my wife and I tried this, I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine back in the 90s, and I had our library, our research people, our fact checkers go through every old issue of Organic Gardening, the Old Farmer's Almanac, books on homesteading and foraging, and we really tried to follow the best directions we could. So do you actually ever collect and use black walnuts yourself?
Not recently, a long while back. And that's what we used, like a big, it was my grandfather's old vise on the workbench. And we used that. And then you have to be very careful picking out the meats because the inside on a black walnut is a lot harder than an English walnut, so you have to be really careful you don't get pieces of the shell in there.
And then what did you do with the nut meat once you got it out?
Well, you could just put them in cookies. It's really good. Or if you sprinkle them on ice cream or mix it with whipped cream and a little sugar, it's really good.
And you buy the crushed black walnuts in the store every year and make cookies?
Yeah. Or sprinkle them on top like a butter cookie. You could just sprinkle them on top before you put them in the oven, mixed with a little sugar. Yeah.
And where do you have to go down south to go into this time machine and find this last?
Into Borden's. It's Lafayette, Louisiana. It's 2 hours west of New Orleans on I-10.
Okay. Well, they'll be heading out soon, Peg. All right.
Okay.
All right. It's time to get my next black walnut beater upper on the phone. So
have a nice day.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who's been anxiously awaiting this all clear that we are now in the perfect zone for spring bulb planting time. The soil is still warm enough to encourage good root growth, but it's late enough in the season to prevent premature sprouting. Just don't go looking for all the details in the A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to help you beat the basil blight, build better beds 8 different ways, and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is time to put our raised beds to bed for the winter. We'll tell you how to do that with compost and fresh fallen leaves. We'll also tell you how not to do it with compost and fresh fallen leaves. We're also going to take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now we are going to talk about a subject that got a lot of attention over the past couple years. Everybody talking about the basil blight. So whenever there's a blight in the house, we turn to our plant pathologist, Margaret McGrath, everyone just calls her Meg, associate professor at the Long Island Horticultural Research and Extension Center. Meg, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you back. You are joining us via Skype. Thank you for doing that. You're the blight girl, Meg. I mean, I'm sorry, but you're like the Morticia Adams of horticulture. Whenever there's a dread disease around, it's, oh, let's call Meg.
Thanks, Mike. Maybe someday you'll call to hear about all the things that I'm successfully growing for a change.
Well, we are going to talk about that today, and that you seem to have found a physical way to at least limit the damage of this blight and grow some good-looking basil. But before we get to success, we want to dwell on the failures. Let's talk about this blight. We've had you on for the dreaded late blight of tomatoes, which is, of course, associated with potatoes as well. And we've had you on about the impatiens blight. And now we've got the basil blight that's been around for, what, about 3 years? And it's really a specific downy mildew?
Yeah, actually, a little longer than that. First showed up in the U.S. in 2007.
When did it really start hitting people's gardens? When people noticed that they seemed to be unable to grow the basic form of basil, the sweet Italian large leaf basil?
Depends on where you are. So I've seen it every year here on Long Island since 2008. And from the reports I've gotten from gardeners over the years, I continue every year to get a gardener or two who will report who had never seen it before. So it all comes down to the luck of where you're trying to grow basil, whether the spores of the pathogen show up, and I think also the weather conditions. If we get a year that's particularly wet, a little bit cooler down in your area, so sometimes I think it gets too hot in mid-Atlantic area for it. All depends upon the weather and the pathogen being present.
And the specific variety, it's my understanding, and I could be wrong here, that it is just the old original basil, so to speak, the Italian large leaf sweet basil that's affected. And there must be hundreds of other varieties of basil, right?
Well, sweet basil is particularly susceptible. There are a bunch of spice types, the Thai, the cinnamon, the lemon. They're not susceptible or less susceptible, depending on the type.
But I've also grown some basils that were very basil-y. They just had a different shape, like they would grow up in a column or something like that. And they would have much smaller leaves. Is that a clue to the fact that the larger the leaf, the more susceptible it's going to be to any kind of mildew?
I think the leaf size and shape more can play a role in favorability of conditions. You get those large leaves, and when they cup down, it might just be a little more humid in there, just a little bit better for the pathogen.
Have you seen the blight in any of the other varieties?
I have, not to the same extent. And that's been a source of resistance. They've tried to get some resistance genes out of some of these spice types that seem to be less susceptible.
One of the reasons that we thought to call you is a listener sent us an article about some breeding experiments you are doing with the other, as you call them, more spicy basils to try to breed some resistance into the large leaf Italian. Have you made any progress there?
Oh, progress is definitely being made. I'm not the one who's doing the actual breeding work. There's a breeder at Rutgers University who's taken the lead on this. And it's a lot of crosses. Typical traditional plant breeding, you take something that's got a resistance gene and it usually doesn't resemble what you want your horticultural plant to be. So it might be a spice type of basil, a tiny leaf. You cross it with your conventional and now you end up with something that's sort of in between and it doesn't taste quite right and leaves are small. And then you do a lot of what's called back crossing, where you're crossing it with your traditional sweet basil and trying to get to a point where you have the resistance gene and nothing else from that source of resistant plant, good sweet basil flavor and the good big leaves. And I know the initial work at Rutgers, what came along with the resistance was a little bit of a licorice flavor. Well, those of us who like licorice is fine, but you really don't want licorice taste with in a sweet basil leaf.
We're talking conventional hybridization, right? Where you're taking pollen from one flower, putting it on a pollen of another flower.
Correct. You're doing traditional crossbreeding. Yep.
Your advice with the impatiens blight was if everybody would just shut it down, would just not grow these plants for a couple of years, the pathogen would die off from starvation, and we could all go back to growing impatiens again. There's very little chance of that happening with one of the most popular herbs in America, right?
That's for sure.
So you ran an experiment, I'm guessing it was this summer, with potted plants where you were able to kind of use like sneaker net, your own 2 feet to move plants in and out. And you really did establish the importance of high humidity for this pathogen having a lot of success.
Yeah, I've been doing this now for a couple of years. Basically, it's growing the basil in pots. I've got it outside on my deck during the day, so it's getting some sunlight. And then at night, I just bring them inside. Right inside the door is where my washer and dryer are, and I just set them on top of that for the night.
Now, you're not doing this just on nights where the dew point is supposed to be high or there's high humidity. You're just not taking any chances. You're in and out every day.
That's correct. Actually, I need to confess, in case my husband happens to be listening to your show, he's the one who's usually helping with bringing the plants in and out.
So you brought in these pots of basil every night. What was your success rate? Did you have any losses due to the downy mildew?
I had none at all.
And you had a good harvest?
Yep.
Did you notice any decline in the harvest from the plants being moved in or out, or maybe it got a little bit better?
I can't say that I saw any disadvantage to doing it, but definitely by the end of the season, there is the advantage of not having the cold night temperatures.
Come on, let's be honest. You had to miss a couple of nights. You had to be away for the weekend, or you had to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and go, oh, my babies are outside.
Rarely. We've gotten pretty good at it. And there's been times where if I'm away just one night or two, I'll just leave them in the whole time.
Right. And
basil will tolerate some less sunny days.
You know, basil will actually grow in an extremely sunny windowsill, or especially in one of those plant-growing windowsills where you got the kind of fake little greenhouse going outside and you got glass on all sides.
Yep, those are very nice. Don't got one of those.
So what do you think? How are we doing on this? What's your prediction for next year? Are you seeing it increase in people's gardens, decrease? Did it hit a certain level and then kind of level off like a lot of these things?
I think it varies with the year, you know, how favorable the conditions are. Once we see a good resistant variety on the market, and that's going to take a little bit more time, that will make a difference. The better growers are able to control any disease, the less inoculum, you know, use the scientific term, is out there for the rest of us.
Right. That was your proposal with impatiens. If you remove the food for 2 years, the organism starves to death.
Right.
Would it be helpful as well? Let's say you have no choice but to grow some of your basil outdoors. Would it be helpful to really harvest promptly as soon as a leaf is full size to get it out of there and open up the plant at the bottom, improve the airflow, get the biggest leaves out of the picture, get the leaves that can fold over and maybe touch the ground out of the picture right away?
That might help a little. My impression is once you get into that high humidity at night, it's just going to be high around all of the leaves. If you can get some, really generate some air movement, and I've seen this more in a greenhouse environment where they'll use fans so the leaves are always moving.
Mm-hmm.
But I think outside your humidity, you know, it gets up into the 90s, close to 100% on nights, and that's a really hard level of humidity to try to have an impact by removing leaves or using fans. The only other technique that's worked, and it's also only been done in the greenhouse at this point, is exposing the plants to light for a good part of the nighttime.
Really?
The pathogen needs a dark period in order to make those spores.
Oh, that's really intriguing. So somebody up in, say, Minnesota, where the summer days are at much more daylight, might see this less than somebody down where it doesn't change that much?
That's an interesting question. I think you still have less than 6 hours of darkness. That seems to be the critical. The pathogen needs 6 hours. So I think you're talking more somebody who's up in a little further north, up into Canada.
All right. As always, we have enjoyed talking to Meg McGrath, Associate Professor of the Long Island Horticultural Research and Extension Center, our favorite plant pathologist. Meg, thanks again for being on You Bet Your Garden once again.
You are welcome. It was fun, and thanks for the compliment.
All right, take care. We'll talk to you again soon.
You too. Bye-bye.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Laurie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my question.
Well, thank you for making it, Laurie. Where are you?
I live in suburban Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for you?
Well, my lawn recently developed a sinkhole. A three-foot round of grass fell about 3 feet deep and appears to be like a four-foot oval cavern underneath.
Whoa!
I don't see any water or reason for it. My soil is very clay, and supposedly the area is not known for this happening.
And you're actually in D.C. legally. I mean, you're male.
No, Montgomery County, north of D.C.
Oh, okay. Because I was thinking, you know, the city itself is really old, and I think it was built on a swamp originally.
Right.
That's why nobody can drain it.
And that's such a shame, isn't it?
But you live in Maryland, just outside of D.C.
I live in Maryland. The property was originally 4 acres, and there used to be a big old house on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it got subdivided about 25 years ago.
Okay.
So I really don't know what's under there. I watched them kind of build the house in the neighborhood, and, you know, everything got leveled off, and we were down to dirt when I moved in.
Okay.
But I caught your program about the walnuts, and I have a ton of walnut trees. I'm thinking about filling this hole up with walnuts. Walnuts?
You know, there was a risk at some point over the past couple of years where we thought we should maybe change the name of the show to You Bet Your Fig, because every other call was about fig trees. I had a feeling once I mentioned black walnuts, we were going into the twilight zone with these things. But now you're not telling me how delicious they are or how to bake cookies with them. You're going to fill in a sinkhole with them.
I just want to get rid of them, actually. You're right. They're absolutely a mess. And every year, well, not every year, every couple of years, I end up with 20 or 30 bags full of, you know, lawn walnuts. A lot of trees.
Okay. And you're thinking of using some of them as ballast, really, here.
Yes.
Filling in the hole. And then I presume you're going to cover that with dirt and you're going to try to regrow the lawn on top of that.
Right. My son is very concerned. He's very into organic gardening, though he hasn't started yet, about what may be under there. And he keeps telling me I need to have the experts come out. And I'm thinking, with what? Sonar equipment? How do you know, or who do you call? I called Miss Utility. There's no water in this hole.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
even after the rain.
So you did call 811, the number you're supposed to call before you dig?
Yes.
Okay, and did they tell you about the neighbor's water line?
No, they told me that since I'm not digging, they couldn't help me.
Oh, okay.
They would only mark the line if I was digging. And there's two apple trees nearby, and I was concerned about what the walnuts might do to the walnut trees.
Okay, so here's the deal. I think it's a great idea, and I think it's totally organic. I mean, otherwise you'd have to go out and buy dubious topsoil or something like that to fill in the hole, and you're going to obviously have to buy some soil to help out. But I think filling the hole with organic matter like walnuts and acorns, if you have them, would be great. And by removing the walnuts, you're preventing evil squirrels from having even more food and breeding more prodigiously. I know you're DC squirrels. They're terrorists. And the acorns are dangerous because they feed mice that carry ticks. So any of that stuff that's not easily composted or otherwise utilized, I mean, tell your son you're keeping it out of the waste stream. You're returning it to the earth, and it will eventually become good soil. One thing I know about black walnuts, obviously we know that they are toxic to some other plants, especially the root systems of black walnuts. But the juglone, the naturally occurring chemical that inhibits the growth of some plants, is in every part of the tree, the leaves, the branches, the fruits. And I am absolutely certain, based on my past research, that lawn grasses are completely unaffected. a black walnut will kill a tomato plant instantly if they're anywhere near each other. But lawn grasses are totally unaffected by the juglone in black walnuts. I know that strawberries grow well near black walnuts. Squash grow well near black walnuts. I'm not sure about apple trees, but I'll give you a great resource. Go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. Click on Garden Answers A to Z at the top of the page. Go to B for black walnuts. And in my article on black walnuts, there are click-throughs to research articles and extension service bulletins listing the plants that are affected by black walnuts in the area and listing the plants that are immune. But I think basically it's a great idea, and I know your lawn grass will grow well back on top of it.
I am very happy to hear that. I've been looking at this hole for about a month now, scratching my head. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I'm tired of people yelling at me that black walnuts taste great. So the idea of putting them in a hole and bury them really appeals to me right now.
Right. Me too. I don't have to lug them too far. So thank you very much. And great show. I'm a newbie, and I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, Lori.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will be honored to once again host the Empty Bowl Dinner to benefit homeless families this coming Wednesday evening, November 15th, at the Lutheran Theological Seminary on Germantown Avenue in Philadelphia. There'll be three seatings, 4 o'clock, 5:30, and 7 o'clock. Lots of delicious donated gourmet soups, a handmade bowl for you to take home, and me. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to make your beds and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will make your beds for the winter. We'll tell you what to do with all those fabulous fall leaves and any compost you have left over from the spring to rejuvenate, revitalize, and most of all, not to harm your beautiful raised beds. In the meantime, though, a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Patsy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Patsy. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you doing?
I am just ducky. Thank you for asking. Where is Patsy Fine?
I am in Princeton, West Virginia.
Oh, okay. Very good. Beautiful country out there. What can we do for you?
Well, my friend informed me that you were running down on black walnuts.
Yeah, okay. We changed the name of the show. It's official. You bet your black walnuts.
Well, she knew that we have a black walnut tree in our front yard that I grew up with. So we have dealt with black walnuts all my life.
And you like them? You eat them? You make?
We eat them a lot. We use them in cookies. My sister still lives on the farm where I grew up. And we deal with black walnuts every fall. And she makes cookies for my nephews, two of them. And puts them in that. She makes zucchini bread and pumpkin bread and puts them in that. She makes my oldest living sister her birthday cake, which starts out as an applesauce cake and then adds the fruits so it turns into like a fruit cake that has black walnuts in that. Cranberry salad at Thanksgiving and Christmas.
So, now, are you involved in the harvesting and the cracking?
Well, my sister does most of that, but we pick them up off the ground. I help her with the leaves in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And we pick them up, and we've always put them on. We have a rock road that goes up to the barn.
Right.
And we lay them out there, and then we run over them back and forth to get the outer hull. And so you pick those up and you let those dry out for a few days and you share with the squirrels and the chipmunks and let them get their share too. And you don't have to start cracking them out right away, but you gather them up and put them somewhere. We have a basement, so we have a small anvil that my mother always used and a hammer to get the hammer back the outer hall.
Oh,
and then she would put them in like a colander or something, and then she would sit and spread a newspaper in her lap and sit with that in her lap and pick out the meat part while she watched television.
So you're talking about, quote, a curing process where the nuts just sit out somewhere for like a month or two?
Yes. She would spread them out on paper or in a pan or something, and leave them out for a few days. According to the weather would be how long you'd let them set to dry out.
Okay. Yes. And then did anybody ever eat the nuts fresh, or were they always used in cooking?
Oh, no. We didn't eat them that much fresh because it took so much work to get them out. But we could, you know, some. But we didn't do it a whole lot. But Mother would freeze them.
Oh, okay.
And use them cooking along the way. We could eat some if we wanted to.
And, you know, what I'm hearing from people is these were often part of some very special Christmas dish.
Like I say, our cranberry salad and so forth that we have. My sister has a neighbor who makes a black walnut pie, like a pumpkin pie. And so often they're used for that. Now, we have bought them one bag. I think we got a commercial at Sam's. And my sister said it seemed to have a stronger taste. And we don't know whether it's where they were sealed up or how long they've been picked or something like that.
No, we've heard from other people that you can buy them at certain times a year in supermarkets, but you're saying you preferred your fresh ones.
Yes.
Okay. And so what's your favorite drop-dead perfect black walnut dish if you had to pick one out of all the ones you've mentioned?
I think the cranberry salad, especially when you only get it like twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the only time we make it. It's like Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Well, see, I don't know if I can trust you here, Patsy, because it's my feeling that everything grows sweeter in West Virginia. So
we actually have a Black Walnut Festival in the state.
No.
In Spencer, West Virginia. And it's been going on for 63 years. It's up close to our state capital in Charleston.
Hmm.
And it's been years since I've been to the state fair, but went to the West Virginia Extension Office display, and they had pamphlets out with recipes that you could get for black walnuts.
All right. Well, that's an excellent resource for all the other people out there who want to prove me wrong. Go online, go to the West Virginia Extension, and search black walnuts, and I bet you'll come up with this recipe list.
Yes. Could well be.
All right, Patsy. Thank you. I have been re-educated. I will no longer speak unwisely of the taste of black walnuts.
Well, some don't care for it because it seems to be stronger than some nuts. But, of course, like I said, I grew up with them.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's delightful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Have
Bye-bye.
A good day.
You too. 1-888-346-9499. Terry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How you doing?
I'm doing good, Terry. How are you, sir?
I can't complain. If I did, nobody'd care.
All right. So where is Terry not complaining?
I am in just north of Indianapolis, Indiana, in Westfield.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, sir, I'm of a pesky mulberry bush outside my back door here, and I don't know how to get rid of it. I don't know if I should pull it or take a flamethrower to it or beat it or what.
I'm just thankful it's not another black walnut call, Terry. Yeah, I'll take anything at this point. Oh, man. All right, so you have a mulberry tree. Now, have you tried the berries?
Yes.
And what color are they, and how are they?
They're like purple and dark red.
Okay.
I believe it's a mulberry bush.
They're kind of Christmas tree-like shaped fruits, not round, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. You know, some of the berries are absolutely delicious, but that apparently is not your experience.
Oh, well, most of the time I've got birds out there so much, and I don't know which ones to eat and not. So I just let the birds have them.
Mulberries are funny because obviously they can be pesky. They can drop their fruit and make a mess. But my old buddy Lee Reich, who's a fruit growing expert, he's been on the show and he's talked about mulberries. There's all different kinds, all different colors. There's red, there's white, there's black. And, you know, for many years, people thought that the black mulberries were the best tasting and the ones you should look for in the woods. But Lee has found out that it has nothing to do with the color. It's the individual plant. Some plants produce delicious fruits. Some plants produce fruits that look exactly the same but are totally bland or off-tasting. And based on his advice, I found a couple of mulberries in the woods near my house. And every season, I go out and pick one of the bushes like mad. They taste just as good as my raspberries.
Yeah. Well, see, I don't really mind mulberries and stuff like that. I just don't like where it's at.
Right. So this is a plant, and I'm guessing when you cut it down, it regrows from its stump or it sends up shoots.
Yes, it does.
So I forget the name of the problem plant that we talked about where I found this technique. It was a buckthorn, actually, I believe it was, which is a highly invasive tree in some parts of the country. And all of the advice was to paint the stumps with herbicide. And even then, it really wasn't very effective. And then somebody, I think it was an extension agent, decided to just nail a tin can to the cut off part of the stump. And it did not grow back. And then when the little sprouts came up, they would either, as you say, torch them with a flame weeder, or just bury like a coffee can over top of it and make sure it couldn't photosynthesize. And it turns out to be a highly effective technique. And what I like about it is it's very little work. You can still get metal cans. One of my favorite coffees comes in a metal can that would be perfect for this kind of work. And then after a season or two, when you know that the plant is really dead, you can pull off the cans and recycle them.
Okay. Sounds good.
You know, other than that, the basic answer to all these kind of things that keep popping up is if you take it to the ground. You really scalp everything. And then you just start mowing the area. Every time shoots come up, you just mow them down. After a season or two, you'll exhaust the root system. But I kind of like the tin can solution. It seems like less work, and from what I've heard, it's highly effective.
Well, I didn't know it would be that easy. I thought maybe I'd have to dig all the roots up and, you know, root ball it and just haul it off somewhere.
With plants like this, you always leave a little something in the ground. And that sounds like a lot of work. And one of my philosophies of gardening is if you're doing a lot of work, you're doing something wrong.
Yes. Sounds good.
All right,
good,
give it a try. Yeah, give it a try, Tar.
Okay, I will do that.
All right, good luck to you, sir.
All right, well, thank you for your advice. It probably saved me a lot of trouble.
I hope it does. All right, you take care.
All right, good man you are. Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Prepping raised beds for the winter with compost and leaves. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with one of this week's two questions.
I'd be happy to, Mike. Henry in Ambler, PA writes, I've heard you talk about adding leaves to raised beds. I want to add compost to my raised beds instead, but I'm leery of buying bulk compost because I fear it may have originally contained treated grass clippings. I found bags of, quote, raised bed soil in a big box store that contain a number of different ingredients. I've copied and included the label. Do you think this would be a good addition? I also have some peat moss and thought about adding it to the beds. Would that be okay?
Let's start with the peat moss. No! Although the packaging makes it sound like an all-purpose ingredient, it is not. Peat does lighten soil and improve drainage, but it contains little to no nutrition and it's highly acidic. It would be really easy to screw up the pH of a raised bed by mixing in one of those giant compressed cubes of the material.
And isn't peat farming bad for the environment?
That's a really complex question. The research I've seen strongly suggests that European peat bogs have been way over-harvested, and their ecosystem is endangered. But the big bricks we see at American garden centers are from Canadian peat bogs, which seem to be very well managed. I use milled peat moss, but only as an ingredient in container soil mixtures and to acidify the soil around acid-hungry plants like blueberries and azaleas.
And your old adage comes to mind here. Just because you have a lot of something doesn't mean you should use it in your garden. Especially if that something radically changes the soil pH, like peat moss or wood ash.
You know, and interestingly, the bag mix that Henry wants to buy does include various forms of peat, but with limestone specifically added to adjust the pH. The other ingredients are composted rice hulls, composted bark, and perlite.
Huh, that sounds more like a potting soil for containers than, quote, garden soil.
Well, that's my thinking. Now, I didn't see any names on the front of the bag, just the ingredient list, which seems pretty good.
Still, it sounds like you'd support using what's in the bag.
Yeah, but to get the drainage benefits of that peat and perlite, you're going to have to till it into the beds. And that's going to trigger dormant weed seeds to germinate and release nutrients from the beds. Kill a lot of earthworms, too, unless the soil is bone dry. Now, tilling might be worthwhile if these beds are really heavy, but he'll have to level the surface afterwards, water the beds well, and then use a really sharp hoe to slice the little heads off of all the new weeds that pop up. And once you make a raised bed properly, you shouldn't ever have to till it. So if these beds really need work, go overboard now and add lots of soil lightener so you can leave them undisturbed in the future.
And his compost worry about the possibility of lawn herbicides being in the mix?
It's very rational. I keep urging big municipal compost facilities to reject grass clippings at the gate, the way they do in Prince William Township, just outside of D.C. But he can easily test a small sample of the compost in question. Fill a container with the compost, plant fresh seeds in it, and keep it watered. If the young plants that emerge look healthy, there's no issue with herbicides. If they come up looking stunted, don't use that compost. And please report your results to the people who are in charge of making that compost.
Which brings us to a related question from Mike in Woolrich Township, South Jersey. He writes, I'm clearing out the summer vegetable plants in my raised beds and have a wealth of finished compost ready. Should I leave the compost in my piles until spring, or should I dig it into the raised beds this fall?
Neither. One of the realities about making your own compost is that it's much more likely to be ready in the fall than back in the spring. But that's fine. Definitely harvest all you have now. You're going to need to clean out that finished material to make room for the new batches you'll be making from this season's shredded fall leaves and spent garden plants.
And make sure you leave lots of soil attached to the roots of those plants. That soil is teeming with microbes that will kickstart the composting process.
Exactly right. Shred the leaves well, chop up the spent plants, mix it all together, and you'll make great compost. Then just spread the older finished compost on top of your raised beds. Don't mix it in. Then cover that compost with an inch of freshly shredded leaves to protect the nutrients over winter.
Rake off the leaves in the spring to help the soil warm up quickly. Install your new plants and then put the shredded leaves back in place to prevent weeds and attract earthworms.
Well, that sure was some interesting information about winterizing your raised beds now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to short sheet my beds if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location and put the actual subject in the subject line. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to ask us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. We continue to send get well wishes to Elizabeth Perez Luna, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Against all odds, Ken Queter continues to play our theme song. Our parole officer, Sweet Staven Naomi Sterobin, is looking for character witnesses. What luck! Our engineer, Al Banks, is in the Witness Protection Program. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, protects our Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz spin a web of mystery, intrigue, and really big type at our website. Petite Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor is big and tall, Al Banks. Somebody needs to put some meat on our intern, Robert Fogarty. Our head chairman, associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. I'm double redundant Mike McGrath, and that's why I might even see you again twice next week. Next week. How far south can you grow raspberries? Can blueberries get rust? And why do some apple trees grow their own Halloween decorations? I'm Mike McGrath, and we'll firm up those fruity fulminations on the next You Bet Your Garden.